You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 135.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Glad to be back. That was a clip called Too Long by Yael Naim. Now, if she sounds familiar, she's the acclaimed singer-songwriter from Israel, now living in France. She gained some fame when her song New Soul played during the Apple MacBook Air ad campaign a couple of years ago. She has such a sweet voice, I think you'll like it, so stay tuned for the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. I'm very excited about my interview today with Michelle Weiss. She's the executive director of the Sandbox Collaborative. That's the R&D arm of strategy and innovation at Southern New Hampshire University. She's also formerly the senior research fellow for higher education at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation. Now, I must say the idea of disruptive innovation has been on my mind for quite some time. In fact, for those of you who are not familiar with this book, Clayton Christensen wrote what's now a very famous book, The Innovator's Dilemma: When New Technologies Cause Great Firms to Fail. I believe that was written back in 97. I actually gave a presentation talking about those ideas and how it relates to higher education in 1999, and I also talked about it on my podcast a number of years ago. So I do have links to my previous podcast on disruptive technology in education. So I met Michelle at the recent Blackboard World meeting. And when I found out that she came from the Clayton Christensen Institute, I was very anxious to hear what she had to say. And for those of you who are following the ideas about the future of education, higher education, I guess, specifically, I think you'll find this an enlightening conversation. We talk about disruptive innovation in regard to education, moving from institution or faculty-centered education to student-centered education. We talk about online competency-based education, performance-based assessments, and how our business model needs to move away from the Carnegie unit. We talk about grade inflation and credit transfer problems. For those of you who don't know, the Southern New Hampshire University has been very far out front when it comes to doing online, and they spun off a separate unit to handle that, and we'll talk about that. And what traditional universities and incumbent learning management system vendors should do in the face of this disruptive innovation. So I think you'll find it to be interesting. And so without further ado, here's my interview with Michelle Weiss.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today and my audience. It's a very interesting time in education, I would say. And some of my audience probably know a little bit about Clayton Christensen and his Institute for Disruptive Innovation. I understand you were a fellow there. How would you describe disruptive innovation?
So it's definitely a buzzword that is misused pretty rampantly, but essentially all it is it's a process by which a product or a service really takes root in simple applications at the bottom of a market and then moves up market, gaining traction and improving over time, and eventually has the ability to displace the incumbent or the established competitors in an industry. But I think most people will just sort of see a new technology and often call it a disruptive innovation because it disrupts the norm. And they sort of use that, the definition of disruption, in its connotative sense, but this is a very specific term of art.
How's that been applied, that concept applied to education? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, so historically, education has really been seen as an industry that has been immune to disruption because there hadn't been some sort of technological enabler to help those folks at the low end of the market sort of start moving up market. But really, things started to change in 1989, which is really when online technologies started to become just good enough to be deployed in education. And so you saw the rise of fully online private ventures like, you know, the University of Phoenix, DeVry, these different groups that were trying to attend to a population of students who couldn't afford to quit their day jobs and pursue an education. And so they built this sort of online education pathway that enabled people to keep their jobs and sort of do progress through their education at their own pace.
Right. That's right around the time I moved into academia. I was at Thomas Jefferson University, and of course later in the 90s, we adopted Blackboard as our learning management system, which, you know, was sort of a grassroots innovation. But I think in terms of your theories, that was more of a, I guess, a sustaining innovation?
Yeah. So Blackboard really, in that regard, it was just sort of a technological enabler. And so in itself, it's not a disruptive innovation. It's as though, you know, Blackboard would probably be the analogy similar to saying the internet is disruptive. The internet itself is not disruptive. It's that technological enabler that helps a company or some sort of group actually put all the pieces together, create the right business model around it, target the right consumers, and make sure that it's also sort of redefining what it means to be good. And often what people don't understand about disruptive innovations is that they are really quite simpler, more convenient, and less expensive products that appeal to new and less demanding customers. Mm-hmm. And so people tend to think of something like Blackboard as online education, and that's really just a place in which people use technology, and that's only just one very simple example of how you would actually display your content. But there's so much that goes into calling something a disruptive innovation. You kind of have to have this convergence of three vectors where you have the right business model, the right consumers, and the right technology.
One of the other technologies that we institute at my current institution, the University of the Sciences, when I first started there, was lecture capture. And I think, okay, well, that's innovative, I guess, in your parlance, an innovation, but it was just sustaining innovation. It really didn't have anything to do with their business model and the way that they were using it.
Right. If you're not doing anything to sort of change or capture a different audience, or if you're not doing anything to lower the price point and increase access to a whole new population of people, then it's probably more along the sustaining, because you're just trying to help your existing customers and the performance of your product for your existing customers or your existing students in this case.
You know, education, higher education especially, I guess, is really under a lot of pressure, you know, with the changing demographics and the competition. So what sort of advice can you give to traditional universities to help them succeed in the face of the changing demographics in higher education?
I think there are two things that I would probably say. One is, I think as everything is changing and evolving, and it really does feel like there are these tectonic shifts occurring in higher education. And so I think there may be this tendency to sort of stand firm and say, well, this will pass and this is the trend. And really, you know, the strength of brand name, prestige, these other things that have held sway in higher education will continue to hold true in this space. I think that would be probably a mistake to consider. I'd like to think of this as a moment in which we're finally starting to change our approach to teaching and learning. And really, instead of higher education being more institutionally centered and faculty centered, it's really becoming about the student. And I think the students are really going to become a bit savvier in terms of how they shop for higher education and how they hire higher education to do a certain job in their lives.
That's a good lead into the idea of competency-based education. We hear some lip service, you know, in that regard to at certain universities. And I guess a lot of it has to do with the Department of Education and what's acceptable to accreditation bodies. How is that evolving?
So competency-based education has been around for decades, but now it's really coming to the fore because there has been so much vocal dissatisfaction on the side of employers talking about how they are not able to meet certain needs within the workforce by hiring even newly minted bachelor's degree candidates. And so there's been a lot of dissatisfaction being aired on the side of employers. And then there's also been quite a bit of focus from policymakers on who I think are also being affected by that, the side of the employers, making this quite obvious. But then also we're at this moment in which tuition is just so costly that mm-hmm. students have to think about whether there needs to be some sort of economic relevance to their majors or how they think about higher education. And so in this kind of perfect storm where federal and state subsidies are decreasing, all this pressure is mounting on higher education. I think competency-based education has kind of been seen as some sort of silver bullet mm-hmm. in this situation. And it's not that it will be a silver bullet. I think there are just some really fascinating things that are evolving in terms of how people are packaging competency-based education. And so one of the things that we wrote about last year is how there is quite a bit of disruptive potential when you put together online technologies with competency-based education and align them to workforce needs. And what's important there is, and I think this is sort of the perfect encapsulation of a disruptive innovation, because those three things separately are nothing new. Online technologies have been around for decades. Competency-based education has been around for at least 40 years, and workforce training has always been around. But when you combine these three in this new model where you have places like College for America, Northern Arizona University, University of Wisconsin, kind of playing around with these different models, some of them are really focusing on what is more a B2B model, where the learning provider is actually collaborating with employers to find out where is your unmet need and what is it that you're looking for in students? What kinds of competencies do you need? Do you need the students to demonstrate? And then they're backwards planning and mapping a program for getting to that point. And they're not doing it in a way where it's pure vocational training. They're doing it in a way where they're sort of imbuing the curriculum with liberal arts training. It's not just multiple choice answers. I've heard so many different sort of mischaracterizations of what this is. It's not just pure multiple choice exams online. It's performance-based assessments. It's constant formative assessments that really provide differentiated feedback for each of their students to make their way through these different learning pathways. And that is really exciting to us because we see that focus on the learning outcomes come to the fore. And it's not about how you achieve that learning. It's just about making sure the learning is fixed and the time is variable, as opposed to mm-hmm. our current way of sort of viewing that in terms of the way that we break everything down into seat time.
Right. And that must be very hard for traditional universities to conceive of moving away from the Carnegie unit and changing their whole business model.
Yeah. And this is powerful in the sense that it really starts to point to the vulnerability of just sticking to what you've got, where I think a lot of institutions, traditional institutions, may think of their peer institutions as competition. And so they may look at a provider that doesn't have a legacy or hundreds of years under its belt and say, well, that will never compete with what I do at my traditional university, because they're also viewing quality as meaning a specific thing for their students. And this is where the importance of the definition of a disruptive innovation is so important. It really changes the performance metric that we are using. So even though we may define quality as X, in a small liberal arts college, for an online competency-based provider, their measure of quality is very different because they are attending to a very different student population. And so when we think of the way in which we think of competition in the traditional higher education market of the United States, we have these different tiers, we have the Carnegie classifications, and we tend to think of peer institutions as meaning these certain universities that we may compete with. Because these potentially disruptive entrants are coming in and attending to a real need in the market, they are going to be able to prove to a different student population that they can meet their needs, even though they don't maybe have that kind of brand or the allure of a certain kind of prestige or that legacy of many years under its belt. And so that's really important, I think, to think about, is that brand name is not going to mean as much just because some of these providers are able to directly usher their students into jobs and where they're making a pretty good salary, or whether they're already, they're just recruiting directly from the workforce in that B2B model. So there are just different kinds of models that are emerging that look nothing like what we traditionally assume as that kind of core college experience, but often we tend to take traditional campus-based experience for 18 to 22-year-olds and say that is a college experience, but really only 10 to 20% of our population has that traditional experience. Most are these students who are looking for a different job to be done. These are people who are working part-time, they have families, they have jobs, they're tied to a specific region for a specific reason. And so because of all these different heterogeneous needs, there are these different providers who can say, I can nail the specific job that you need to get done in your life by building this program for you. And that's where I think the vulnerability lies.
Also, I was talking to somebody recently about competency-based education, and they said, well, you know, when you get a degree from Harvard or Princeton, you know, that's a quality education. And but then later I read, well, you know, there's something called grade inflation. And just because you spent 4 years, or now it's more like, you know, 4.5 or 5 years at a traditional institution, doesn't mean that you've gotten a quality education.
Yeah, the grade inflation piece is real, I think, really cuts to the core of what's problematic about our system. If you get an A at Princeton, you can't necessarily even translate the credit of that course from an A at Princeton to an, you know, to getting credit for it if you were to transfer to Harvard. You know, and that's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. Those are obviously elite institutions, but we have this problem of credit transfer where there is no abilities to use credits in this sort of currency exchange. It's very akin to the electronic medical records where we have our own personal medical records, but we don't actually have access to them and they're not portable for us. We can't actually use them from provider to provider because from the provider's perspective, they have absolutely no incentive to share our medical records across systems and make it easier for people to exit and enter and go in and out of the system. It's the same within higher education. There is no incentive for the transfer, the destination college, to take in as much credits as possible from the student because they want also the student to take more classes from them as a brick and mortar institution or even an online institution. And so the grade inflation part is really problematic because we have no idea what an A means in a biology 101 course, even if you may have passed it at one school, that doesn't mean that you can actually use it at another school as credit to move on. And this is, I think, something that is what competency-based providers are really trying to enable, but it's not easy. I mean, I think they're really struggling in terms for those who are not in the direct assessment model, they are really struggling to figure out how do you create that transcript. It really right now is let's just do what's easy. And because this is the way the federal financial aid system works, we need to just translate it all back into the credit hour system. We have to sort of use that new light bulb in an old socket. So that socket is problematic. But I think in terms of the new vanguard of competency-based providers, they're really trying to think about how do I make this set of skills and competencies and capabilities and dispositions really legible to employers and help students understand what it is that they are learning so that they can translate that as they make themselves marketable in the workforce. And so that legibility issue is I think really foregrounded in the work that these different providers are doing. They're trying to think very, very deliberately about how they make this more obvious so that transcript isn't quite such a black box.
You know, when you think of the new technologies and even competency-based education, and you think, okay, we're talking about online, and there are some well-known schools, Southern New Hampshire University being, I think, at the forefront, who've been able to be successful, at least from what I understand, in creating an online version of their university, at least for certain disciplines. How is Southern New Hampshire University able to evolve that way? How are they able to do that and become successful in online?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story of the way it evolved at Southern New Hampshire University. Really, I think what is unique about the way that the president, Paul LeBlanc, thought about it is that he really took the theories of disruption to heart and used them as a playbook for innovation. So he knew that if he wanted to create some sort of new growth unit, he couldn't do it within the existing traditional model. And at that time, he had his traditional university campus, and he was already building just an online program, which was seat time based, which is just sort of a more traditional online continuing of education program online. And while that was starting to really gain traction, he realized, I kind of have to start thinking about what's next and what is it? Where are those non-consumers of higher education? Where are those people whose alternative is really nothing at all? And so he housed in a very separate autonomous unit. He allowed this sort of incubator of a new idea to exist, and it didn't have to create a business model that fit into the traditional existing campus model. It didn't have to fit into the College of Online Continuing Education. It just had to build its own model. And that's where they started to move towards understanding competency-based education and why that was important. And then also trying to create a new business channel so that it wasn't cannibalizing necessarily the other businesses, but really targeting those other students who were not being attended to, who were being underserved. And so it's a really interesting model in which he has really taken the theories and built out these separate units and allowed each unit to just sort of bloom and grow on their own without having to connect to one another necessarily and fit in. And so he took the lessons that Digital Equipment learned, for instance, when the personal computer was really being commoditized in the 80s, Digital Equipment was trying to figure out, how do I capitalize on this growing market? I don't know what's going on in the personal computers, but I know that I should be paying attention to it. And both Digital Equipment and IBM saw that something was going on with the personal computers. But Digital Equipment tried to fit it into its existing business model. And so the only way they could make the personal computer make sense in their business model was to charge $50,000 per personal computer, which at the time they were only selling for about $2,000. Dollars a unit. But IBM realized that they needed to set this up as a separate shop, and they created a new sort of heavyweight team to lead the charge in Florida, far from their New York and Minnesota offices, which were taking care of the mainframe computing business and the mini computer business. And they said, hey, you guys in Florida, you can think about your own way of fostering this kind of disruptive growth, and it can be low overhead, it can be high volume, it can be low margins, but you don't have to make it fit into the mini computer business or the mainframe computer business. And they were the ones who were able to really brace for this disruption coming down the pike, whereas Digital Equipment, because they couldn't figure out a way to foster that separate growth, they collapsed.
That's the example I always use when talking about disruptive innovations. Of course, one of the other areas that I talk about a lot in my podcast is certainly the educational technology. And so that always brings me to the question of learning management systems and other learning technologies. I was wondering what you can say about what, you know, the incumbent learning management system vendors such as Blackboard, what do they have to do to not be innovated out of existence like a Digital Equipment Corporation? What do they need to do to make sure that they have a future?
That's a really good question. I usually think about it more from the institutional perspective and less from the incumbent LMS provider's perspective. But I think the thing to be aware of is now there's even a movement outside of the LMS market to create what is more a learning relationship management platform. You have places like Flat World Knowledge Emerging, Fidelis, these different groups that are trying to build on top of a CRM solution. So it's not just about pure content, but understanding how the students are really engaging with the material. And I know that a lot of the incumbent learning management system providers are thinking about this and trying to evolve their models. The question that needs to be asked is, will the attempt to sort of take in all of these new and emerging innovations end up driving their prices up for their existing customers, or are they really attending to a new customer base? And I think that's where the question is. I think for now, places like Blackboard and, you know, these other large providers are probably safe for a little while just because it's so difficult for incumbent traditional institutions of higher education to switch over their system easily. It takes a tremendous amount of IT effort to do that. So right now, I think they're a little bit safe in that space. But especially for startups, they're just building their own technology to do what it is that they need to get done. And then for those who are creating these sort of new autonomous units within their existing business model, they're open to looking at very different kinds of LMS or LRM kinds of providers, or they're thinking about building their own. And so it's going to be difficult for a place like Blackboard to create anything but a sustaining innovation, just because the forces are just so strong within a successful business model to just keep moving in that direction. It's very hard to think about making better products and services for your best customers for better margins and just sort of stop doing that and tackle something else.
Right. It was interesting that after Blackboard World this year, which is where, of course, we met, that then they announced that they're basically putting themselves up for sale, at least their owner was.
Yeah.
In the analogy with digital equipment and IBM, maybe they should spin off a unit to do something really innovative. The other question occurred to me, are there any other schools that like Southern New Hampshire University that are going that route that you see, that are spinning off a unit to develop, you know, a better, you know, student-focused online presence?
Yes. So Brandman University is a spinoff of Chapman University. Mm-hmm. I believe that Northern Arizona University has tried to separate its online competency-based education from the traditional campus experience. I don't know how definitively they are separated, though. I know that at University of Wisconsin, they struggle with that just because they've tried to house it separately within the extension school, but the extension school itself has no degree granting power. So there's a challenge there. So it's not truly an autonomous unit. But there are also places like Purdue and University of Michigan that are just trying to build a separate program and make that an online competency-based education program. And then WGU has been experimenting with different community colleges and helping them through Department of Labor grants as well as Gates Foundation grants to help these community colleges figure out, how do I maybe just transform one program within the university and see what kinds of shifts need to take place when it comes to admissions, when it comes to the registrar, what are the implications for the transcripting process? And they try to understand how it's affecting the entire culture of the institution by just trying to mess with one program. So you see these different kinds of modes of experimentation. I think the groups that are probably struggling the most are the ones who realize that they haven't been able to separate. That separation really needs to exist, just because otherwise the faculty within the institution, which is, again, this is unusual in terms of the way the business model of traditional higher education works, is that the faculty have so much power that the governance structure allows the sort of changes and modifications to happen to what could be a disruptive innovation. If it's housed within that existing system, all of the forces of having to orchestrate your resources and all your different processes, it's going to affect what that original solution was that was trying to be built. I think a good analogy is just sort of to think about how a bill gets modified from its inception and when it gets enshrined as law. When someone has like an innovative solution to a problem, it will just get modified over time just because of the forces that it has to appease, like a powerful senator or the Chamber of Commerce, all these different kinds of entities that have the ability to put their fingerprints all over the solution. And ultimately what you get is something so different than what you started with. And I think that's what happens when you try to house something within the existing business model, is that what you start out with as a good idea can get changed and modified so much that it will ultimately probably become purely a sustaining innovation for the university.
This has been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. I could go on, I think, for another hour or two, but I think you've given my audience a lot to think about. And, you know, the traditional institutions are forewarned, you know. You know, change is in the wind, and I think they better wake up and take a look. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the Innovation Lab? It sounds like a pretty exciting position to be in. What's your goal there?
It's twofold. I think one is to serve as a kind of internal consultancy for the university, but then the other is to really think about what comes after next in higher education. So even what comes after the College for America model at Southern New Hampshire University, how can we attend and expand access even further and really try to bring a low-cost, high-quality education to more people? And that includes exploring what the next generation of learning assessments looks like and how do we potentially partner with industries and government and other kinds of institutions to create new business models of higher education. So it's really exciting. It really feels like an extension of the work that I did at the Clayton Christensen Institute. So it's a really exciting time to be in higher education. I do want to say that the discussions of disruptive innovation shouldn't be seen as folks are the harbingers of doom. It's really an opportunity to rethink what it is that we prioritize in higher education. And in this particular case, it's really coming down to how are we setting our students up for success? And, you know, as much as people may hate hearing me use business model analogies when it comes to higher education is a business. It is about consumers, whether it's the student as the consumer or whether it's the employer as the consumer of those graduates in training. It is a business model, and we're at the point now where it's just getting too costly for people. And so we have to rethink what it is that we're doing. And I always like to use the case of MIT, where, you know, in their latest task force report, they are really trying to think about this changing student demographic and these changing student needs. And they're realizing that their students that they're going to accept in the next 10 years are going to come in with all of their gen ed requirements completed through maybe massive open online courses or other open educational resources. They're going to come in with having done all of that, or maybe they took those credits at a community college. So they're trying to think, how can I create a totally tailored, personalized learning experience for these students who want to understand how they translate all of that knowledge into learning how to do things and how to make things and how to build things and how to think about things more critically? How do I build that kind of new tutorial experience for my student? And MIT is thinking about that. So if MIT is thinking about that, it's probably a good sign that we should all be thinking about this.
That's right. A great way to sum up our talk today, and that's why I'm so excited about what I do and what I need to research, because I see there's so many ways that technology can be used, and oftentimes it's hard to fit it into traditional classroom. But you know, we're moving forward.
I think if faculty can just sort of see the use of technology as relieving them from some of the more mundane day-to-day things they don't want to do to enable them to do the things that they wish they could do, this is the opportunity to think about that.
That's right. Well, Michelle, thank you again so much. I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more from you.
Thank you so much, Rod.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. I will say that there's something in my inbox almost every day about these kinds of issues, and so I have a number of links on my show notes, reading list. Certainly, it'd be worthwhile getting Michelle Weiss's book called Higher Education, Mastery, Modularization, and the Workforce Revolution. It's a very inexpensive ebook. I think it's $1.99 through Amazon. And of course, The Innovator's Dilemma. And I did happen to read a pretty recent article by Evan Goldstein in the Chronicle of Higher Education, where he talks about the undoing of disruption and how some recent research on some of Clayton Christensen's data seem to fail to uphold all of his theories. So it's an interesting read, but I would take it with a grain of salt. And also a recent blog post by Phil Hill talking about the university as EdTech startup. And of course, he mentions Southern New Hampshire University among other institutions that are, you know, rolling their own, so to speak. So that's it for now. Please stay tuned and enjoy the song Too Long by Yael Naim. Until next time, have a great week.
I waited for so long outside myself. You see, I was pretending to be someone else. I was longing to see who I wanted to be. And I've been waiting on my own.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.